Welcome to the Waiting List Podcast.
Tell us the story.
It's like many things you start building from scratch.
And then I'm like, wait, I really do like watches because...
You've seen so many watches that makes you excited.
Yeah, I think I really, really do like watches.
Yeah. I think it's a great way to see if you are a watch enthusiast.
Okay, welcome back to the Waiting List Podcast, co-hosted with the insatiable Long Long and the Chinese James Bond, Alex Lau.
And if I had a license to kill, you'd be my first target.
Dude, that's cheesy as fuck. Alex is just
get that out then, man.
Just aggressive, just a bit aggressive. A bit aggressive. Today, our guest is someone that I'm sure many of our listeners know of, and certainly know of the establishment he works for. I had the fortune of meeting him during the Auris launch event of the Pro Pilot X in Shanghai. And from then, we've kind of become friends. It's Cole Pennington from Hodinkee. So welcome, Cole.
Hey there. Pleasure to be here. Virtually, okay. Of course.
Before we start the interview, I want to say thanks to everyone that's listening. It really makes us motivated to keep doing the episodes. Keep sending us feedback, whether it's through the Instagram or comments. You can find us at Shanghai Watch Gang or at Long Long Tun or alexlau.ar. Of course, you can also find us at the Waiting List Podcast. It would also really help us if you guys could follow, subscribe on whichever platform you're listening and press the notifications on so you get to know when we drop the episodes. Right. As I was formulating the questions, I realized there's simply just so much I wanted to cover with you. So I split the interview into two parts, with the first part mainly focusing on Hodinkee. So let's get into it. My first question, how did you become a watch journalist? Is it something you had always wanted to do?
Is it something I always wanted to do? No, actually. I kind of fell into this job. I started off by doing research for myself, you know. So we'll back up. I was living in Thailand and buying vintage watches from little stalls. Have you been to Bangkok before, by the way?
No.
Yeah.
All right. So y'all ever heard of JJ Market? Chatuchak Market?
Yeah. But Alex only goes to Patpong. So
no, I don't know what that is. I'm lost now. Beyond my scope.
I don't know about that. So I was going around to JJ Market buying watches. And at the time, and I would say even now, the tastes in Asia and the tastes in the Western world were very different. So some I was just keeping, some I was, you know, what happened is a lot of the cool watches got fished out of the Western world and they were still there, like Endicars and so forth. You can still buy in Thailand at the time. Whereas in the Western world, we didn't have them anymore, right? There was a decent amount of scholarship done around it. They became cool. So I was buying all these brands that I'd never seen before. And I started keeping like personal notes, like doing research and writing little articles for myself and so forth. And then as I developed, I started to write about watches for like little publications for friends, for a few magazines that I worked for in Thailand, just kind of on the side. And then when I got back to the States, I went to grad school, and in grad school, we had this project. I went to grad school during 2016 in America. That was the election year. So crazy year. But as one of our assignments was to use something called the Freedom of Information Act, FOIA. So you can do something called a FOIA request where you write to the government essentially, and they give you everything about a specific topic. And for me, you know, at the time, and even still, I'm just not into politics, really. So the assignment was really just, you know, use this to learn about policies that had been written, whatever. I thought, hey, why don't we use this to get pictures of previously unseen Apollo era stuff, NASA, military, whatever, government programs, Antarctica research programs, and look at the people in the pictures and see what they're wearing. Because this era, like 2000 to 2010 to 2015, this was the time when, like, you remember Analog Shift? You guys follow them by any chance?
Yeah, really good. Analog Shift's really good. Yeah.
They're awesome, yeah. So yeah. James, he was doing a lot of research. They made a lot of watches. So like the Rint, Nina Rint, they really made those watches by doing the research around and around them and finding the story. So my idea was, okay, the government has a bunch of cool documents. Let's see them. So I was in the middle of that project. I know this is a long-winded story, but I'm getting
to the point. No, that's great.
So I was back home, back going to grad school, whatever. Hodinkee was hosting a meetup at a jewelry store, you know, just drink whiskey, look at watches kind of thing. So I went up to Ben and kind of like low-key pitched him the story and said, hey, I'm sitting on a bunch of documents and watches that haven't really been, like, nobody knows that, like, you know, people make a huge deal. It was a massive deal when people discovered that the Pogue went to space, that Seiko chronograph, right?
Right, okay.
Like, it became the second space watch and so forth. So I had kind of discovered a few watches that were also used in space that hadn't been written about yet, whatever. So I pitched him the story, and then he said, yeah, let's, you know, meet a few people, this, that, the other thing, and eventually it turned into a job offer, actually. So that's how. And so, no, I never planned. In fact, before Hodinkee, I was going into the military to fly helicopters. So no, I had never planned on doing this.
Oh, right. Wow. Well, that you actually answered the next two questions for me there, because I was always wondering how you actually got into the Hodinkee job. Actually, like, how big is the team there?
The whole company is mid-50s now. But keep in mind, there are, you know, different silos. So there's shop. It's really divided into two sides.
Right.
The shop team and then editorial. And editorial, it's me, James, Steven, Jack, Danny Milton, John Buse. And then to a degree, Kara, she writes there as well. She's a little
less than 10.
Yeah, on the editorial side, yeah, less than 10 for sure. But then shop team. So another thing too, we were in the process before COVID and all that, we're in the process of building out like a full-fledged retail space and so forth. So staffed up for that as well. So yeah, there are 50 people total in the company, but 10 are like kind of, you know, consumer facing or like reader facing and so forth. Maybe a little bit more than that, actually, more than 10, like, because Ben is also facing folks and so forth. But ton of people behind the scenes make it work as well.
What about a social media team or anything like that?
So Kara does that. She takes care of the social media. Also, we share those responsibilities as well. But there are teams that, like, you wouldn't even think about, like web development. And it's a web dev team. There's a design team. There's a video team of three people. The video team also does the podcast. So two producers produce the podcast as well. There is an advertising team as well. So there are a bunch of little units within that shop side. And on the edit side, it's just video and web. Oh, and the magazine too. So we produce a print magazine 4 times a year. So those duties are kind of split up between edit as well. So
I think that's very interesting for a lot of the listeners, because when I was in Hong Kong, I spent a lot of time with Phillips Auction House, and you actually find, you know, they work in a very nice building, and you've got literally probably four people which are client facing, and then the rest of the team are photography and and video. Like, and but that team is pretty big, you know, like, so you've actually got maybe 3 or 4 people that actually know about watches, and the rest are actually just supporting.
I would say here's one thing about Hodinkee. Like, one of the web developers, Ryan, everyone knows a shit ton about watches. That's true.
Right. Like, that's great though, isn't it?
Yeah.
Everybody loves watches, and they're working in the watch industry rather than the watch industry where you got a lot of idiots that don't know anything about watches and trying to sell you watches. And they don't really know what they're selling. You don't even know luxury.
Yeah,
you know?
Totally.
I want to know, before you signed on to do the job, were you kind of set that, okay, for the rest of my life, or at least for the next year, I was just going to write about watches instead of like writing about cars and maybe other things you're interested in?
So here's the deal with that. There's so much overlap. So like the first year that I was doing this, I've been there a little under 2 years now, I think. I went to Goodwood to watch the maiden voyage of the IWC Round the World flight. So there, okay, you can write the story, which is actually more about planes than watches.
Mm.
Then, like, went to Goodwood, the auto Goodwood Revival. This
Festival
auto,
of Speed, right?
I've been to Festival of Speed, but right. The Revival is what I did a story on for Hodinkee. So because of the overlap, you really, like, and you guys know this well, a watch is just a watch without a good story. So, like, yeah. The story usually encompasses something else, right? The story is never really about a watch. It's about a person. Mm-hmm. It's about triumph. It's about cars. It's about whatever. So going into this, did I say, like, all right, I'm not going to write about anything else? No, I thought, like, going into this, I'll use the watch as a lens to look at other things.
All right.
And that kind of happened.
That's cool. Yeah. Cool.
Because I was reading this article, I think one time Hodinkee did an article regarding talking about a car, and there was a massive backlash and people giving really negative comments. And then basically Ben had to step up and just say, "All right, guys, just calm yourselves down." Basically,
is that another way of saying you wrote a negative comment? Saying other people wrote that's kind of the shit you would pull.
I want to apologize, but I'm a massive fan of cars, so I'm very open to car outlets all over the place. But you must have known that article as well, right, Cole? Yeah.
No, I actually don't know which one. We've done a few pieces, but so, like, for instance, coming the last weekend, literally a few days ago, it's today, Thursday, so 4 or 5 days ago, I went to, like, an air-cooled
9/11.
Porsche rally.
Yeah.
Yeah, 9/11.
Yeah, so. I saw that on the stories,
Yeah, so while I was there, we kind of spun up a story right then and there, because there were a ton of very cool watches with super interesting stories right there between all the drivers. And the story will be simply, like, Watches and Wheels, which is a format that we kind of, and actually we did do Festival of Speed too. So between Revival, Festival of Speed, we just do the kinship between automotive watches and tell a little story and throw up some great pictures. And so we will do that story soon too, hopefully.
So when you did the FOIA article back when you was looking into NASA and the watches that were worn there, did you also do about the cars they had? Because most of the astronauts were driving Corvettes, I believe.
Corvettes, yeah. So that was a sponsored thing. So GM, literally, that was a marketing move. But I will tell you a cool story that I wrote for, you ever read Petrolicious?
No, I haven't read this one. No.
Yeah, I know that one. Yeah.
All right.
This is a good one. You should check it out for sure. Okay. Well, it's under new ownership now, so who knows the direction it's going.
Alex, you're not really a car fan, mate.
But back then, there was something very cool, which this is a story you should check out if you find the Corvette story interesting. There was a Pontiac GTO that NASA bought secretly and took it to, like, a local speed shop and told them, like, make this thing fast as hell. And this was all, like, on the side. And they used that GTO to actually tow a model of a lifting body design. So, like, the space shuttle doesn't necessarily have to use thrust to lift. The way lift is produced is unconventional in that. So to test that, they took this Pontiac GTO that they secretly built on the side and towed models of what would then became the lifting body design of the space shuttle, you know, a decade or two later. But that was kind of a cool thing where NASA literally went to the private sector secretly and said, build me, like, underground street racers, like, build me this car. And that was just a cool kind of story.
Honestly, that
vehicle. You can Google that. I think it's out there.
Yeah, how much torque must that thing have? It must be crazy. Putting a lot of weight.
500.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Not too much. Not too much.
What's really coming across, actually, in the I don't know how many minutes we've been talking about, is I've interviewed many other journalists, but you see, you've mentioned that you were at Goodyear, and then there was, you know, it's about airplanes, and now you're mentioning cars, and each time you've noticed a story about watches, but I'm not sure everybody else would have seen that there's a story there, like there's a story to be told there, and you naturally have a very inquisitive nature, and the not only that, but the drive to actually find out more about it, because people just stop at the first question and they think, I don't know, I don't know the answer. And they actually focus on what the show is about, which is probably airplanes or cars. But you focusing on things, and do you think that ability is what makes a good journalist? The fact that you can see stories that need to be told and other people like floss over them.
Yeah, I would say, I think the most important trait for anyone doing any sort of writing like this is curiosity, for sure. Like looking around the next corner or turning over the next leaf and kind of sniffing around for a story. The thing about watches is that they're like magnets for good stories, right? They literally, if you just ask somebody, you'll get something. So the thing is, it's actually pretty easy to find a story connected to watches if you just, you know, look a little further, right?
Yeah, but I think right now we're so used to people like yourself who come up with those creative stories that there's a lot of people that don't exercise their brain. And because I think one of the things you were talking about in your talk with the Horological Society of New York was that you hope to inspire and empower other people to ask those questions, ask those stories. And you came up with the hashtag something like always look at the case back or something like that.
Always read the case back.
Always read the case back. Yeah.
Yes, sir.
So yeah. I mean, I personally do look at some old pieces. I mean, my latest purchase has been a very old Shanghai military watch from the 1970s. Awesome. Yeah. But you know, I would say, you know, my Instagram page wouldn't exactly highlight that. It always tends to be like I play to all the high pieces, I guess.
I mean, that's why, like, hypebeast and do you know hypebeast?
Yeah.
Like this culture, the hypebeast culture, has bled into watches. But I would say, like, the OG forum people, like old Purist Pro
Watch Pro site,
Watch Pro site, exactly. Like, all that stuff is way more focused on what we're talking about, not the hypebeast model. That's like the next gen of really, who knows, has social media ruined watches? Yeah, maybe to a degree, but there are a lot of people out there still. Their voice is just very quiet, right? Like you don't really hear those people much, but there are plenty of folks really, you know, in tune with the horological lore behind X, Y, and Z, or reading the case back or getting the history, but they're just not writing the articles that get a lot of hits, to be honest.
You kind of need the eye candy before people start going deeper. Because I think majority of people, let's say they look at it on face value. I think even John Mayer was the same. He looked at something face value, then slowly, once he understood about watches, then he was like, ah, do you know what? There's something really deep and meaningful about it. So I think it's just probably a phase that most people have to go through.
Well, it's also, I would like to turn the tables here and talk about mainland China and Hong Kong, how it's happened. But in the States, at least, watches are now mainstream. Like the Supreme crowd knows what's up with the latest Rolex drops, where that would never happen, you know, 5 years ago or whatever. So like, there's an element of horology that has at least the mainstream audience or people paying attention are now, exactly. They're now paying attention to watches. That's a relatively recent thing here. I would say StockX, Hypebeast, Supreme, crazy stuff affected that. Is it the same in Asia? Asia is a broad category, but in your markets.
I was going to say, like, Shanghai, mainland China, is very different to Hong Kong. In Hong Kong, you have all of the Western trappings of the social media, right? You don't have any of that social media footprint in mainland China, but you will have it in Hong Kong. So Hong Kongers are exposed to that side, plus the history of it being a colony. So I would say it's probably similar, but I mean, these two can probably better answer that. But in Shanghai, in watches are, I wouldn't say, you don't see them everywhere, for a start. There are a lot of people here. A lot of people wear watches, but they might not be modern watches, because you have a load of Chinese watches as well that actually Chinese people wear. But I would say, yeah, that culture of what you're talking about, the people where, like, I don't know, Supreme or Off-White, this kind of generation, I think
Are they interested in watches?
Yeah, too? Because like what it is, I think, is that whole mentality is, I need to show off, I've got the latest thing, and I'm like really with the in crowd, right? Mm-hmm. But there's only so much you can do with clothing before you think, because it's getting more expensive, but clothing can only reach a certain level of expensive, a price, right? Right. But then if you wear a watch, suddenly you can elevate what you're wearing even more.
Mm.
And then say, oh, I've got the latest Offshore, I've got the latest Hublot or something like this, or the latest Patek. And I think more and more people are doing that because they're seeing
it's the same.
But then eventually it's going to go to a point where I think generally in China is people that are buying watches, especially buying the nice watches, it isn't enough to say, I've got the money. Look at me. I'm balling it out here because I've got the money. Check me out. It's okay. You wear that. So do you actually know anything about what you're wearing? Right? Do you actually have the knowledge. Because you just look like a fucking idiot. Like you just bought it because you got money. You got nothing else about you. It's not enough now to have money because loads of people in China have money. Right.
Yeah. A lot.
But I think the majority of the Hong Kong people, it's still, I don't think they actually understand what they're buying. Right. If you look at the latest auctions, like Phillips is doing like the crossover stuff. So you have like luggages and pop art and then watches that are around the same price range, but they're just pushing out stuff that they think people are going to buy. So they put in a lot of Hulks, subs and everything that fall into that, about 10K to 20K USD watches. And then people buy it because they think, okay, if I buy this Rimowa, I should probably be wearing this watch and I should probably hang this type of art at home. Instead of being like, with 20K, what can I buy? Which I actually think sucks, because if you know you have so much power in your hands to actually influence like that generation, you should actually educate them, you know, instead of curating for them like a starter pack, like this is how it is to be cool, you know?
Yeah. Well, that's what this podcast is, right? This is educating the future.
I think also if you look at mainland China, the way mainland China is being brought up, a lot of the population, I'm generalizing here, okay, they've not been taught to ask questions. They've been asked to follow. Listen, and not ask questions. Because that would, if you had a population that kept on asking questions, it would be very hard to control.
Yeah.
And so it makes sense that they look at certain 老师, which is like teachers, of pillars for information. And what they say is gospel. So they haven't had that time to develop their own creativity, their own style, their own confidence in saying, oh, I'm inquisitive about this, I'm going to ask a question about this. But I will say the next generation will, and that's kind of like our generation. So because most of us have been, well, all of us here have been educated in the West. So we combine both of them, knowing the issues that we have in China plus having some Western. It really is a mix. Like when I think of Shanghai, I really do think like you've got, like let's say the West was red and, oh no, China was red and the West was blue. And then suddenly you put the paints together and you mix it together and you get this splash, right? That's exactly what Shanghai and how I feel Shanghai is.
It's very splatter of purple.
Yeah, it's just amazing. Yeah. Well, actually I would say Hong Kong is just, everybody says it's like, oh, East meets West, the Orient. It's not.
It's totally so west. Backwards.
Yeah.
West backwards, basically.
Yeah. No, Alex, you must agree, right?
Yeah.
And you know what? You know what's the other thing, which this is just a theory, though. I feel like if you're Chinese and you go to dinner, say with 20 people, and then you buy a watch that you know is going down in value, that's not going to hold value, people are going to laugh at you. And they're going to be like, what a dumbass. Unless you're shitting money, there's no, like, why would you make such a dumb decision? And people can be very, what is the word?
Skeptic.
Yeah, well, not condescending, but they will make snide remarks.
Rude.
Like, yeah, rude. Like, they'll be very direct. Like, that's not a really smart choice. So I'm not sure if that's the same in the US, but in Asia, you generally have to act savvy. You know, you got to know what you're doing kind of thing. Yeah.
I think it's the opposite here, believe it or not. Like,
mm-hmm.
the guy or girl, of course, who goes and buys a watch, which we know is going to lose value or whatever, they're baller as hell.
He's the proper baller.
Well, that's what it's like in exactly. That's what it's like in China. If you have the money and you buy, yeah, you are balling it out. You have to have the knowledge. Whether it falls cost, that is actually not that key. But in Hong Kong, it's really key. Like, because they see the watch game as a way, forget the money side, of knowledge side is on an investment side. If I can demonstrate that I made money, didn't lose money, or I made more money than you, that gives them more brownie points than saying, I bought a watch, I've got all this money, but I don't care. That not, because even the wealthy operate like that in Hong Kong. Like, yeah. They really look at the investment value of the watch.
That, so what's interesting to me is this mindset dictates what is popular. That's why, like, in Asia, blue chip brands are everything. Like, so for instance, maybe Jorn would have a difficult time rising in Asia until it rose in the West. The West made it cool. Then finally, it's a demonstrable investment. Now, all of a sudden, it's cool in Asia.
Yeah.
Like, that, Rolex yeah. is, yeah. yeah. So,
but this is, sorry to cut, interrupt you, but this is something that the art people in the auction houses were saying. So whenever there's an emerging artist, they basically take the piece, they bring it to the West, do one round, and then bring it back to Asia. Same thing.
And yeah. hype it up a little bit, yeah.
Yeah.
To demonstrate yeah. that this is cool.
So you basically need some validation from the West to be like, this is worth buying. And Asian people are like, yeah, all right.
But in the end...
If you look at the history of Shanghai and Hong Kong, they had a very strong Western influence
mm-hmm.
where Western culture was seen as very stylish. You look at 1930s Shanghai, Art Deco, mm-hmm. it's a very West driven. If you look at the Bund, the reason why the Bund is hot right now, because it was made by the West, right?
Yeah.
Like that was where the West stayed. Hong Kong, exactly the same. You had the British
mid-levels, wherever they are.
Yeah, it's all the West. So they're also, when the West came in, they had money. So everybody wanted to aspire to have that money. So you had to cozy up to the British, to the French. No, it's true though.
Carl, we'll work with you, right? Get Hodinkee to talk about, let's say, a watch like, I know, IWC or something. Say that doesn't go up in three times in value. And then we bring it back here and then we just make it happen. we just kind of own that kind of manipulation of the market.
But here's the thing though, what I think is, it doesn't even, so there's this whole East-West conversation, but it's actually, it goes down to core thinking. I think like the way I see things, like why I do think America will lose its edge and why China will rise is because you guys think in decades and centuries. We think about the cool thing next week.
Mm.
So that's the same way about buying watches. Like you're buying watches that will increase in value over the long run, right? Where here it's about like, I'm going to go down to hang out with my boys and I want something no one else has. And then I don't care if, you know, 2-3 weeks from now, it's uncool anymore. So that I think really the reason blue chip brands are popular is because yes, you're demonstrating your knowledge and your business acumen and being savvy and investing, but really it's, I'm thinking about decades from now, as opposed to what's cool this season, you know?
Yeah, totally. This applies to everything, even like marriage. You're like, I'm going to marry this girl. She's ugly as fuck, but she can cook and she looks like she can have a lot of kids. So like, okay, that's like Asian people. Yeah, good wife, good mother.
And in the end, beauty fades. Cooking and cleaning does not.
Nah, it does. Yeah.
Totally.
Yeah.
Right, I'm just going to bring it back to Hodinkee now. So sure. I wanted to ask like how it actually works there, but you kind of answered that slightly. But I wanted to take a particular example. You recently wrote an article about the Datagraph, a very, very long article. How does something like that come by as opposed to just a normal editorial piece?
All right, so I guess you set every, you know, a few times a year, we set larger objectives. Think about, okay, how can we service the readership in a positive way? Or how do we add value? So yes, of course, there is introducing hands-ons, those are kind of quick hit things that come out every day. But Meanwhile, all of us are working on one or two in-depth pieces. So in-depth, you pick a watch and you pretty much amalgamate every bit of information that's out there and then try and add more to the conversation. So we, you know, all pitch a few ideas, like what watches are worth spending a shit ton of time researching and writing about. And then you go and do it. So, you know, you might, like, for instance, that Lange thing, you start a file. Maybe, let's say, I probably started that in April, maybe, sometime in the spring. Start a file. Anytime, do a little research here, a little research there, and just drop stuff in the file. And then finally, over a few months, you have all this information. You've interviewed the company, Lange itself. You've interviewed people all over the world who know a thing or two about this model. And then, you know, over the course of a few months, you've built up a massive amount of information about this. Then you distill it down, write an article. So the objective for those is to really, like, bring new information to the market. Not to the market is a way, the wrong way to say it, but add value to the readership by doing original research and scholarship around the watch. So in that Lange piece, like, there was a lot of stories and media that had never been seen before. So, like, I hit up Lange, Tony de Haas, Mr. Schmidt himself. Like, they went into the archives and they found pictures from, you know, Baselworld back in the day and sent them to me. So that adds value to the readers because here's a bit of lore that you never knew about before that we can present. So
just to make that clear, was that article sponsored by Lange?
No, not at all. That was sponsored by Cole Pennington, right?
Okay, no, I think it's very clear to it's very important to clear that up because I think a lot of people would have thought that.
No, I mean, number one, if you were to ask Lange, do you want to push the datagraph? They'd be like, we don't need to push the datagraph. Why would we ever pay someone to write an article about something that they're going to write an article about anyway, right? Because it's an important watch. No. So on Hodinkee, at least, advertising is clearly marked. Like, yeah, as an outsider, I guess, so coming from the inside, I know the way it works, and I can tell you for sure, the editorial stuff like that, we don't even talk. There is sponsored content, but it's very clear, like the mood and tone. If you look at something called like The Seas Out East was a Tudor sponsored thing where like they took a bunch of watches to Montauk and wrote a little story about it, which is the Hamptons on Long Island. Like that, yes, that's paid for by a Tudor. But any in-depth piece on a watch that you see like that, no, that's not. That's just us. We get paid to write that, you know?
That's interesting, because I think as Chinese, right?
Yeah.
The advertising rules are probably a lot more gray. And therefore, you end up just questioning, yeah, that's advertising. That's advertising. You know, because it's not clearly marked. They don't have that kind of journalistic responsibility. So,
well, I would say that's just question journalism. Everything. Well, yeah. I mean, we, you know... constitutionally, it's super important for us to have free speech, all this, da 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 da. So I think we forget about the East looking at the West, like we internally will have a ton of scrutiny and criticism around if we did stuff like that, like didn't clearly mark things. It's just it wouldn't be cool. But you're right, like it's a totally different ballgame. And even still, we'll get plenty of criticism for even advertising to begin with, you know, even if it's clearly marked. So
yeah, Alex is always doing that. He says, oh, I'm gonna give Hodinkee a ton of shit. Yeah, and then do you know what comes the interview, he doesn't say a single word.
No, I apologize. I want to say for a moment, first of all, when you did the interviews about the data graph, did you actually interview Daniel and Lung Lung?
I did.
No,
yeah.
He just made it up, Alex.
Alex, you just
like,
done more or something.
I just like, do you know what? like, you know, write an article about that randomly. But no, if you ask Daniel and Lung, at least they've got like great experience.
You clearly didn't read the article because he actually mentioned Lung.
I
don't
apologize. I haven't.
Andy Zane as well.
Yeah. Alex, I paid him.
He sent it to me. Exactly. How much did you guys pay him? No, but okay. So we had this conversation with another blog. And how do you guys, because like I said,
can you say their name right now?
I think so. Yeah, it's Eru Adams. So basically, we understand the importance of making money. There's no point of doing Hodinkee if there's no profit to be made. But it's a very sensitive topic, I think, when you start, like you said, getting paid advertisements in the UK. But then how do you kind of siphon what is good and what is not? What is acceptable and what is not?
Okay. Meaning in terms of...
Like for Hodinkee, it's like, what is it, for example, just say a random watch brand comes to you and says, hey, look, I'll pay you a ton of money. Can you just go out there? Of course, your answer might say no, but if there's something potentially good to write about it, do you put that into consideration?
So to be honest, and I know this is probably not the answer you want to hear,
but okay.
I know nothing about it. Like no one comes to me. Like my job is very, I have the blinders on. Like, it's just write good shit. That's it. Like, you do that, we'll take care of the rest. So there are other people. So we do have a team where brands will approach to advertise. And so that's an interesting question. How do you say who would make a good partner and who wouldn't? I can't answer that because I don't know enough, but I can tell you that, like, have there been partners that I have seen? There are some that I'm like so about, but some I think we absolutely kill it. Like, I think there's a lot of synergy there to capitalize on. Because here's ultimately what it is, all right, if there's a good story to be told, that's true, right? Not a made up story, but if there is a good, true story to be told, it's worth telling either way. Like, if that comes through in a sponsored content piece, then that's fine too. That's just decent sponsored content. But like, I only really deal in editorial. So like, it's pretty, and they make it that way for a reason. They make sure that I don't have exposure to that, right? That side of the biz. Otherwise, people would be hitting me up left and right to try and, you know, get stuff in, this and that. And I would, you know, it wouldn't work well, work out for me.
That actually happens though in China though. They approach the editors. And they just just give them a bit of money, like, write about this, because you need to make content anyway, right? So you might as well, and it should be cheaper than actually approaching you officially.
Put it this way: I wouldn't do that, and I know that sounds like I'm not virtue signaling in the least. Like, I just wouldn't do that because it's not a good look. But B, it would not get through. Like, it wouldn't pass. So the way things are is, you write a story. It goes through copy edit, content edit, and general, you know who Joe Thompson is?
No.
He's kind of he's a legend in the watch world, in America at least, and Switzerland. He's 74 years old. He's been to decades worth of Basel. He's reported on the industry. He was there for the quartz crisis. Like, if you're talking OG watch writing, this is the guy. So he's the executive editor of Hodinkee. So he's the guy who's sees, like, does this pass the smell test? Like, if something seems shady, he won't let it happen. So the answer is, it doesn't work that way. Like, a brand can approach you directly. Nah. But here is one gray area that might be interesting. Let's say Omega is going through their archives or whoever, right? And they find something interesting that, like, seems like it might be of good value editorially. Will they say something? Yeah, they might. They might, because it's an interesting story for us and them too, but it's purely editorial. No money, no favors, none of that. You know, it's just more like, this is a fascinating story and we want to bring it to a platform where we know lots of people will actually read it, as opposed to, you know, somewhere where they might not read it. You know?
So you seem to basically explain a very clear infrastructure that exists within Hodinkee that actually promotes quality and standards. Do you think that may be one of the reasons why Hodinkee is such a success? And is it a similar model applied to other watch industry blogs out there? like, why do you think Hodinkee has cut it above the other two or the others? There's probably like five or six, actually. Why do you think that they are now leading? Well, I would say they're leading.
Yeah, I would say that there's a few elements. So like a lot of things in life, it comes down to timing and luck, of course. Ben was one of the first people to really dig into vintage in a approachable way. Keep in mind, like when he started this thing, he was mid-20s, early 20s even.
Yeah.
And was kind of doing it as a hobby because he was passionate about vintage watches. And before that, like if you wanted to learn about vintage watches, you would go to like
auction houses.
You go to auction houses, which you don't really participate. It's a one-way conversation. Mm-hmm. You listen and that's it. And I would say, the same way you have these kind of, you're a little skeptical of Hodinkee, which fine, I get it. I am skeptical of auction houses. Mm-hmm. But so to answer the question, I think, yeah, timing, luck, the right mood and tone, approaching things that are usually highfalutin and kind of like stuffy with a down-to-earth tone to a degree. And then also hiring the right people. Like, yeah, since I've come on, I've seen there's a new guy, Danny Milton. You should check out his work. I would say they're pretty good at identifying something no one else sees. Like, we pull a lot of people from outside the industry. So, like, people who love watches who don't come from the industry. Like the guy, the programming software team, they all came from like organizations you know about, like Facebook, whatever. Danny, the new writer, he was a lawyer before this and they pulled him over. For me, I was kind of a weird story too. Like it wasn't really in watch industry or whatever. So I think that's actually part of the success. So I think one thing that happens, that tend to happen is people jump around from blog to blog or whatever in the rest of the watch media sphere, where you're not really adding any new voices to the mix. So that's part of why Hodinkee is successful, because so our COO, Enery, he comes from GM, and he specifically is kind of the guy that made Cadillac cool again in America. Because Cadillac was kind of suffering for a long time. And yeah, he's, I wouldn't say a marketing genius, but he's proven his capabilities and so forth. And because he loved watches, the job at Hodinkee was attractive to him. So the right mix of people, the right tone, a little bit of luck, of course. And why hasn't anyone else? So it also takes, to be honest, it takes capital, you know, you can only get so far on wit and charm and so forth. Then you need a little injection of cash. And, Hodinkee got that early on as well and used it wisely and was smart about it and also maintained quality as they grew, right? So there's very high standards. So like I will say for sure, like I will get reamed out if I am making stupid spelling mistakes or if I don't fact check something, like I'll hear about it, which I would say sometimes when I'm reading other things, I think, well, hey, how did this get published? Like, how did this, who did this not go through to make it to the web? So I would say that kind of is what separates it. But I will also say, like, some of the other blogs are absolutely killing it. Like, there's some amazing stuff out there. And even more so, there's now that, like we were talking about, watches are a little bit more mainstream. And obviously the tools and access to information and tools to produce and disseminate information are more widely available. There are totally amateur things. There's a guy you should check out called The Wristorian. He's just a guy who loves this and does that too. So, and also another guy called K.A. Timepieces, Horolonomics is his Instagram and his blog. He's an economist by day and just a watch nerd by night. And he's putting out awesome content. There's so much great content out there, and it's not always the watch blogs you know about. It could be someone else's blog. So,
I want to know, you mentioned that you have a bit of skepticism with auction houses. Mm-hmm. By that, do you mean that you feel like they kind of push you towards pieces they're trying to download or?
Okay. So put it this way. We'll backtrack. There was an era where auction houses dominated the narrative, right? Mm-hmm. They were the
voice.
Yeah, they were the voice. They were the source of record, kind of like. That is no longer the case, really, only because there are so many other places now that can do that. But the auction world, so put it this way, let's talk about the auction that just happened not too long ago, where like Pepsi's and stuff were going for $35,000. Mm-hmm. Why? Yeah. So you have to ask yourself, like, to me, this is journalistic intuition.
Lulu made a great purchase there. She bought that blue Japanese, I remember. Like, we all stood up in the room and we started clapping like this.
She had the paddle and just kept going boom, 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 like crazy.
Like, she was part of the reason inflating those prices.
I like your style, Lulu. I like it. But, like, that doesn't pass the smell test, right? Like, something's fishy, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, I don't really know. Like, there are people from auction houses that work at Hodinkee. We have Sayori and Brandon who come from Antiquorum and Christie's. Mm. Great. And yeah, they're sharp as a tack. They know everything about vintage watches and so forth. But the very nature of the game to me feels like there must be something else at work. Do I know what it is? No, I don't. Of course not.
Mm-hmm.
But there's more forces at play than meet the eye, I would say.
Right. You must have heard some stories from them.
I've heard a story or two, but nothing.
Yeah, we all hear stories, but I mean, you have to be able to fact check it.
Yeah. Exactly.
Alex wouldn't last a day in Hodinkee.
Yeah, bullshit's too much.
I mean, I think we're reversing. I think Daniel should be there.
You know,
I was actually thinking about my answer, like, to the question I just asked you about why Hodinkee kind of made it, and you did touch upon it about the whole vintage thing, is that you definitely own this vintage watch niche. Mm. And I guess many collectors, you know, myself included, we all know that vintage watches is a complete minefield to navigate, you know, especially when we talk about the history and the originality. And I feel that once Hodinkee kind of locked that down, as a reader, you feel like, okay, now you have the right to talk about all the other pieces. Because if you even know this, then all the other modern pieces, I won't even question it, right? Mm-hmm. So, and I don't think all the other kind of blogs really owned that niche. I mean, we can talk about as a
reliable
brand,
source. Yeah.
It was very, very attractive. You know, the way everything was laid out, it felt classy. It had that whole, at the beginning, you know, Mr. Porter look, it kind of looked very similar to Hodinkee. That was also, you know, very, very kind of important, I think. But I do think it's because you own that vintage side and that gave you the right to speak. Would you agree? I mean, would you guys agree?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I could speak for myself only, really. But I would say, to me, yeah, that is true. But keep in mind that most of the facts and information you read are just, they're quoting from people like Eric Wind, William Messina, so forth, like vintage experts as well. So like a lot of, you're right in that. Like if, and I will say for sure, like with the Lange piece and so forth, everything is fact checked heavily. So, because we know we will be, everyone thinks they're an expert on everything, right? In the comment section. So we know we'll get that. So we
keyboard warriors.
Exactly. So we try and keep it buttoned up, watertight, you know, fact check it three times.
The thing I like most about Hodinkee, actually, I give massive credit for, is actually your video content. You know, the talking watches. And then you had people like John Goldberger, Alfredo Paramico. These guys were fantastic to watch and listen. So what made me warm up to you guys specifically was that.
That is one thing too, video content, which now, so let's talk about, yes, Hodinkee does, they dominate the narrative and we will keep producing things to a standard, which we are always pushing, right? But I will say nowadays, you see, you guys follow Teddy Baldessari?
Yeah.
Or Watchbox, like there are definitely.
Tim Osoy.
Yeah, there's folks on YouTube and doing video, and Adrian, Bark and Jack, right?
Yep.
Yeah.
Crushing it on YouTube. So video is interesting because, yes, Hodinkee was one of the early pioneers to really incorporate video to that degree. But that's professional. Now there's a whole league of pro-am, right? Like amateur / bordering on professional. Jenny L, do you follow her? She's awesome.
Is it the girl with the accent? A little bit of an accent.
Well, she's German, but went to school in Scotland, and so sort of has a Scottish
slash German. Yeah, I watch her. She's interesting. She explains it well. Yeah.
Yeah. So, like, there is a new crop of video content that's emerging. That's interesting to keep an eye on. That is not coming from a major typical source in this this industry, you know. Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, but you also wonder how much, like, all of that stuff, because it's amateur professional. Not saying it's bad, but how much is it fact checked, like, to Hodinkee standards?
Well, a lot of it. So here's the thing, and at least in America, we've proven that we're sort of living in a post-factual reality where it doesn't really matter.
Is this real or not? No idea.
Exactly. But a lot of what they're doing is content and analysis. So it's not really historical deep dives and stuff. That is actually, in my opinion, it's better for the written word. It's better as an article, right? Video is a better medium because you can see facial expressions. You can introduce comedy in a way that you can't in writing. That makes these people charming. Like, I find Jeniel super charming. I find Adrian super funny. I like his sort of cynicism and so forth.
So he has a very, very strong British theme going on whenever you see or watch his videos or listen to his podcast. I was born in England. It definitely resonates because it can't actually be replicated. That
right.
There's little. Yeah. The general feeling is the odd word here, but you add it all together, then you get something which is your IP.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, like, so back to this facts or not, I'm not really going to these people for facts because I'm in it to get their quirky personalities, their funny hot takes. You know, I'm not going there to learn about the history of X, Y, and Z. I can do that on my own. I can crack open a book, you know. So,
so basically, we as the Waiting List podcast have a chance.
No, I think we're just amateurs. They're like, Cole's exactly. Looking at us going, you amateurs, man.
No, I think you have an incredible, incredible opportunity. I've always thought this because, you know, I spent, you know, close to a decade living in Asia too, where I just saw opportunity after opportunity after opportunity, like, oh my God, someone's got to do something. And hey, you guys are at least getting somewhere there, you know, and that's you.
We keep trying. But you mentioned that Hodinkee was going to work and all that kind of stuff. And actually, Hodinkee is a retailer, you know, you sell a lot of brands, you sell vintage watches, you also have straps, you obviously have money coming from the advertising side, and now insurance. But where does the main revenue stream come from? And you probably don't know, but where would you suspect? And has this consistently been its revenue stream, or has it changed along the way?
I would say anecdotally, just based on how most businesses go and what I observe, in the beginning, it would have been advertising and sponsored content. But then that is the elasticity, the amount that there's a ceiling for that, right? Like once you have, how many watch brands are there to partner with? There's a finite number. So I would say that selling straps, watches, whatever, that the ceiling is much higher. So I would say probably advertising ramped up, plateaued, and then selling things can exponentially increase over time. I don't know. I don't know the figures, to be honest. Right. But I would say probably that's the pattern it followed.
If we're leading on to the next question then, we mentioned about the kind of sensitive nature of having advertised or sponsored content with non-sponsored content, you know, about how credible it is, how does a reader find, you know, how about we take the sponsored content out and we say, okay, now you're actually a retailer for these brands, right? How do you balance neutrality there? You have a motive to sell Omegas, whatever watches you sell there. You're Omega. Definitely, are you going to say shit about it, basically? Will you do that?
So here's another thing too. And this is Cole talking, not Hodinkee talking.
That's what we like to hear.
I want to tell Hodinkee to please make sure he still has a job after this interview.
Well, ultimately we're talking about watches, right? We're literally talking about watches. We're sharing enthusiasm and spreading around the passion is far more interesting than sitting back and criticizing. So me personally, like, do I want to read someone talking shit about an Omega or whatever? To be honest, no. I want you to tell me what is interesting anyway. Yes, there is room for criticism in this industry, sure. However, it doesn't really do anyone any good or bring any value to readers to sit back and bash anything, whether or not they're a partner or not. It's more about delivering what is fascinating. So, like, my goal is find what's interesting and deliver it to people. Because who am I to say X, Y, and Z is shit, this watch or whatever, you know? I'm not really, that is such a subjective thing to...
That's a very interesting perspective, because maybe that's different in China. Because if you look at all the platforms like Taobao and Dazhong Dianping, which are very, very strong platforms, real user feedback, which, you know, can be pretty critical at times. Like Chinese, man, they're so critical. Is very important to the user.
Sure. But yes, I understand what you're saying. You're looking at things from a product journalism standpoint. So like something like what Consumer Reports would do here in the States, right? That magazine is testing products, or like Road and Track will go out to a skid pad, see how many Gs, test, you know. We don't, I mean, when I get a watch in for a review, do I actually test its accuracy? Nope, I don't. I mean, how, like, and also...
Would it really sell? Would it affect people, to make a decision on buying their watch then?
Yeah, but Jack might.
Yeah, Jack, So that's the thing. So my specialty is really historical, interesting tidbits and kind of man in his watch type stories, like this one with the Golden Submariner and the guy that took it on 17,000 dives. Like, that's my beat. So do I really care about the accuracy? Not as much. So I'm not going to... Yeah, that's Jack. That's all Jack. He'll do that. Steven can talk about it from a style perspective, you know, like, so I would say the Consumer Reports type stuff is not really what we do anyway. We try and more celebrate the passion and interesting nature of watches. So, like, yeah, will we say how it feels on the wrist? Sure. I will say, like, some watches feel like hockey pucks on the wrist, and I'm not afraid to write that. We will write that. Even if we sell them, right? That's fine too.
Some people might like hockey pucks on their wrist.
Hey, some people might like a lot more than that on their wrist. You never know.
I think what we're trying to do is we're trying to find clarity when we're dealing with so much information. And what I mean by that, we've got like facts, you've got business, you've got opinions, you've got history, you've got story. And as the reader or someone who's involved in the watches, trying to siphon what is the right information you want can be very tricky.
Fair.
And the watches, like, they swivel around all these different areas, so trying to find something that fits to you is important.
And the modern consumer has changed a lot in how they critique their purchase decision. So, you know, when we were a lot younger, we used to pick up a magazine, really not even think that this might be sponsored or whatever. And now the question marks for the consumer are everywhere. You know, they're constantly asking questions. I want to move on anyway. There's one thing, I guess we're really plugging it, Dinky, because it's coming across as like the gold standard here. But one thing that really marked, I've met you and Stephen in Shanghai. I met you at the Oris event, and I met Stephen at the Bulgari event.
That's right, yeah. Each Bulgari time. And Omega. These are such interesting pronunciations to me, by the way. But anyway.
So I was like thinking, one thing really noticed is, one, how professionally dressed both of you were. How also, after the event, you went there. How both of you came to the event, did your thing, took your photographs, asked the right questions, had the dinner, and you guys pretty much like left. There was no schmoozing with the brands. You know, none of that, I will take a drink and all this kind of stuff. It was really, really professional. I think that's the only time I've seen it.
Well, the reason
is that you have a rule in that?
question is, where did they rush off to?
Exactly. And that's exactly
this is boring. Out. I need to get out of here.
We sorted Cole out in Shanghai. No problem there. You know, he quickly realized, oh, Shanghai Watch Gang, they're the local guys. They know what they're doing.
Exactly. That's exactly it. We had business to take care of. You know? You take care of your business, then you take care of your pleasure. So, yeah, no, I mean, in all seriousness, there is no like grease in the wheels or whatever. Yeah, we're all friends with the people in these brands in a professional capacity and sometimes personal capacity, sure. But like, put it this way, I think as a publication, you should aspire to a standard where you don't have to schmooze the brands. If anything, agreed, they come to you, you know, yeah, you control the narrative and mm-hmm, and yeah, don't beg these people to give you.
Yeah, totally agree. Yeah. Control your own destiny. Yeah.
Exactly. So I think that has a lot to do with it. But and also, yeah, I'm in goddamn Shanghai. I want to go out and see what's up.
Because you know? I can't remember which bar we were at, but the first one where you're on the rooftop is actually renowned for like escorts.
That wasn't me.
Cole, you were definitely there. I was there,
but not in that scene.
Yeah, clearly, obviously, yeah. None of us were there, right?
Not my scene.
We were all looking at the view.
Yeah. Cole was the only one looking the other way.
Beautiful place.
Yeah. Anyway, Hodinkee's been quite disruptive in the industry. Where do you think the next disruption will be, in particular with media? Can you see it? Or
With media? I actually think the answer is already right in front of us. It's clear. It's direct-to-consumer media. So have you heard of Substack?
No.
A few people have. So I think this is true. Like the Western world is definitely a decade ahead in terms of the way media is disseminated and so forth. So now what's happening... So, you know, Jason Heaton from my team?
Yes, yes.
Yeah, great writer, phenomenal dude, just a good all-around guy. So he is doing this a little bit, but all right. So imagine you go to someone for them, not the content. So you go to Hodinkee for Jason or whatever, or whatever, you know? He's a bit of a freelancer too. He's a editor at large, so he's not a staff writer. But now what you'll start seeing is, imagine if you charge everyone $2 a month to get content direct from you. But now you have thousands of people paying $2 a month to get content from you only. So no publication. You're getting Daniel. If Daniel's going around the Chinese watch media circuit writing all these articles, and I love Daniel's stuff, why shouldn't he just... Thank you. Right, I do. It's great. So
I want to use an example, but it's so shitty. Like, I feel bad saying this, but it's a bit like you know, the porn sites and you pay for the girls, like the webcams, like you pay for just that person.
OnlyFans.
Yes. Yeah. It's the same thing, right?
Yes, it is 100%.
I didn't think about that.
Because of you. Thank you. I learned everything from you.
Yeah, that's right? Exactly it.
Yeah.
So basically now you're getting direct to consumer media. So you want to hear someone's totally unfiltered thoughts on something, you get it right from them. And it's fine because I'll pay $1 or $2, $5 a month to hear from somebody. And I'm not alone. Like hundreds of people feel that way, right? So this is the future of media. It's really cutting out.
That's not that different to what happens in, I think, more developed actually in China is the live streaming.
I was going
to
say. The live streaming
where people constantly pay gifts to be on that stream. Like they pay ridiculous amounts of money.
I know,
These streamers, man, they make so much money that I'm even thinking they're using Long Long. You know, $2. We'll put her in front of a candlelit dinner. You know, millions of people come on. Yeah, I think it's a better way to monetize the waiting's podcast.
Okay, wait, one thing. So if this does happen, right? Like, so Hodinkee slowly evolves and it turns into a platform where writers apply and they want to use Hodinkee as a platform. Doesn't that mean the whole business model changes? So you guys, they will start to charge writers to be on their page?
No. So like, it would never go in that direction, to be honest. Like, So here, I think what it is, so for a good example is the Grey NATO podcast. You guys listen to that ever? Yeah. So they were independent, then they came into the Hodinkee ecosystem, and they're all the better for it because now you get tons of new listeners.
Yeah.
You get more exposure and also kind of the good graces of many brands. Now you're more trusted.
Mm-hmm.
So what I'm talking about, so the Hodinkee doesn't necessarily fit into this direct-to-consumer model in any way. This is just more watch media in general. This is how it'll be disrupted. It'll be, you know, you paying a few bucks to listen to X, Y, and Z, their thoughts, because you find them interesting, the personality-driven thing.
Well, in China, a lot of those live streamers are all backed by actually massive companies because it actually requires huge investment. So they will take about, I think, more than half of the profits that person generates. But the card's in their hands. To be honest, you can make anybody good looking on live streaming because the amount of filters, the amount of photoshopping is, again, another level in China. You know, just change the camera angle, filter, all that kind of stuff. Even the ugliest girl will look really good. I mean, I'm saying girls because girls are notoriously used for the method to make
eye candy, basically.
But eye candy and lonely single men to part with their money.
They talk about shit right now.
Dan knows a lot about this because he's met a few girls, and it's just when he shows up, it's all with someone else.
Who is this guy? So that's catfishing, is what that's called.
Yeah, catfishing.
Oh, catfishing.
Yeah.
There you go. Yeah. I got real. You know, the last hook was really sharp on the last one. So. But do you think Hodinkee's like launched in Japan? Will it ever come to China?
No.
What is the situation with Japan? How does it work with Japan, and why will it not come to China then?
China? So this is me talking. Do I know the truth? No, but I would say it came to Japan because it's the right fit. Japan is a perfect market for something like Hodinkee, like very nuanced, very like otaku already. It's kind of pre-programmed into the culture there. And
tell orientated. Yeah.
Exactly, yeah. And it's a partnership with Hearst. So it's not launching from ground zero, like building it from nothing. It's a partnership with Hearst already, which is a developed media conglomerate, right? So it makes sense. China, in my opinion, this is again my opinion, too difficult. Like, and I think you would hear this from any Western company who is trying to enter the market. It's just the way to do business. What's this, Guangxi or...
Actually, like, your relationship, he's on it.
Yeah,
he's so on like, it. Like, speaking the lingo.
So like, there's a lot to doing business, right. A lot to building a brand, building a company. You know, I just think like, why would a bunch of foreigners come in there and do it? Why not start your own thing anyway, right? Like, in my opinion,
it would be much stronger. You guys have a big problem with the French Rainbow.
Yeah, exactly. Like,
which is the cultural propaganda department. Everything, all your stuff would be vetted first by them. That's an extra layer, right? That doesn't go out.
Better to be the best that we can be in markets that we're free to operate in and, you know, capitalize on that than try and do something fighting an uphill battle, right? And also...
Yeah, I think it's a very good answer. Sensible answer, yeah.
And honestly, we want to leave some room for you to...
all right. We file watches already anyway.
Well, I know you mentioned the Japanese market because I find that one interesting because they're the ones that really put Philip DeFour on the roadmap because they're really active on that. I think they're very into like George Daniel and F.P. Jean. There's like an F.P. Jean cartoon comic book that the Japanese market did.
Crazy.
So, right. So I think they are really into that sort of thing. And of course, you know, they've got great prominence with their own watchmakers like Credor and Brand Seiko. So I think they're really up there with that sort of stuff. So I can see it fitting the vibe. But I think in Hong Kong and China, maybe they haven't been developed properly
yet. Hong Kong and China, super different too. I think Hong Kong would be more potential friendly.
Yeah.
I don't know. Because actually, if you look at the Hong Kong market right now, what you're seeing is the real market of the fact that Chinese can't buy there right now. Mm. And there's struggle there. So actually the amount of people that actually do play in the watch space in Hong Kong, personally, I don't actually think it's that big.
They're all on this Zoom.
They're all on like.
No, but Hong Kong still has its advantage though, because most of the access to most of Asia, we do have the tax benefit. So regardless whether China exists or not, like
I again don't from think
Indonesia,
that's
Thailand, Vietnam.
I don't think it's gonna last.
Yeah. No, it's not gonna last. It's not gonna last. Yeah. Well, I mean, things are changing here. If you talk to AP, right?
Yeah.
It actually isn't that much more. It's like 2-3% more. Mm-hmm. So if you talk about some of the collectors here, they don't give a shit anymore. They're like
paying taxes.
They already do. Yeah, I'm talking about the taxes of the purchase.
Okay. Yeah.
Obviously, there'll always be a bunch, but I just don't think Hong Kong will keep that tax thing for very much longer. Because you've got to understand, like, Shanghai has its own KPIs. Shenzhen has its own KPIs, right? They want to take down Hong Kong, right? And it's actually in the best interest for China to take down Hong Kong. But it's more in the control. It's more in the control of China if it's in Shanghai, right? So
Daniel Xinping.
That's what it is, like dictatorship. Yeah. Daniel, you know?
I make my own destiny.
I get that.
But I can't even be in the Communist Party anyway, so I don't hold a local passport. But right, let's round this up. What do you think the effects of COVID are in the watch industry in the short term and the long term, and how has it impacted Hodinkee?
Okay, so how has it impacted Hodinkee? We'll start there. As a response, we set up a bunch of initiatives and carried those out. And now a lot of them are winding down. That's not to say COVID is winding down in the States, but a lot of the objectives and initiatives that we set out to do, we did. So part of what I was responsible for when COVID started was a retailer spotlight series, which was designed to, you know, there was a mandate, you had to close, right? So literally people cannot come into your store anymore. So part of the idea was highlighting retailers that were in neighborhoods that people can actually go to and buy from and support to keep them alive through the crisis, where like they might, you know, a lot of businesses here don't have a lot of cash on hand. Cash flow is, and COVID highlighted that, that really is what highlighted that. So a lot of retailers, you know, had to shut down, like your mom and pop store in the middle of the country where people bought their first tag or whatever, you know? Mm-hmm. So part of the initiative that we did was highlighting all those. So give them some time in the spotlight. That was my job. And everyone had something different. The shop, so this is touching on the second point. The sales of mid-priced watches and more value-oriented stuff, like I'm sure you've seen this new brand, Norcane. You know, kind of a value-oriented brand. Norcane, Seiko, Oris.
Zodiac.
Yeah, Zodiac. Wow, there you go, coming through. Exactly. Like, these are increasing, and people are okay with a feel-good $1,000, $2,000 purchase.
Interesting.
But the super expensive stuff, so the super, super high-end stuff, a lot of the top-tier folks are unaffected by COVID. But, mm-hmm. So that's like, that's the upper class, but upper middle class was affected, right? So they maybe held back and they didn't buy that, whatever, $10,000, $10,000 to $20,000 range stuff. So that
mainly the Richemont group, basically.
Yeah, pretty much, yeah, exactly. Stuff like that. Pretty much, yeah. So sales of, you know, value oriented, lower tier price, up. Sales of, you know, 10 to 20, down. Did it choke the supply chain? Yes, it did. It choked the supply chain, and we're seeing that now, and I don't think it's actually caught up yet. So pieces are still like, they're still behind and not being delivered in the same capacity that they would be prior to COVID. So that's how did Hodinkee, I think I touched on everything there, yeah?
Okay, right. So I want to finish by asking, when things open up, can we fly to the office and meet everybody?
Sure. Yeah.
No, I like that.
Because we were actually going to do a watch tour. Well, it's actually only in my head, and it's more of a hope it happens thing. But, you know, if it does happen, we're going to go to Switzerland and just basically eat a lot of fondue and have a little
drink a lot of wine and cheese.
Maybe make a drop by England and see Roger Smith, and then, you know, on our way over to New York, and then hang out with you guys and have a blast.
Yeah, you definitely can. I mean, we also are opening a proper retail store, which will have space to kind of hang. It's gonna be great, unlike anything you've ever seen before.
It's that plug-in. I'll do it better for you. It's like no other watch place does it like Hodinkee.
There you go. But for real, it'll be cool. And yeah, you can come by, meet folks for sure. I mean, you've already met me and Steven, meet the rest of the team. All y'all can come hang, have a good time, and
great.
I can show you around New York if I'm not living in Asia by then, you know.
Yeah, great stuff. Anyway,
no, so thank you for the hospitality.
We usually finish off our podcast with a quick fire round, 5 to 10 questions.
Let's do it.
So they're just quick answers, really. So here we go. All right. Uh-huh. Right. Tell us one myth about Hodinkee.
That everything is paid for.
Okay. Yeah. For all those budding writers out there, how do you get better at writing?
Find an area where people aren't writing about yet. Don't copy. Try and develop your own style.
Good advice, I think. Which part of the job do you hate?
Talking to us.
No, I think the high exposure to burnout and taking what's normally a passion, and then when you add stress in, it could leave a bitter taste in your mouth. Like sometimes, like I'm not that excited about watches because I do it professionally.
Okay, so this isn't a question that I had prepared. How do you avoid burnout then?
Holiday.
Yeah, and also just, I think naturally there is some weird rhythm where like every time you get burned out, something comes along where you get stoked on again. Like a story I'm writing now, which is super cool. In 1975, there was a communist insurgency in Laos. That China had a lot to do with, by the way. But basically, the Laotian royal family had to flee the country, right? They had to get out of there because the communists were taking over. The prince at the time swam across the Mekong River into Thailand wearing nothing but the clothes on his back. And he only took one thing with him, a Rolex.
A watch. Oh. Yeah.
So like that story, I'm working on that now, kind of putting together the research and everything. And like stuff like that naturally happens where you get fired up again and you forget about how like bored you are of the monotonous stuff. Yeah,
right. All right, next question. Remember to cut that part out, right?
Why right, is that?
I'm joking, we keep it there. How far can smartwatches go and what is their potential?
I'm the wrong guy to talk about smartwatches, to be honest.
I think Steven's like, the right guy, right?
Steven is literally, so he, tech before guy. Hodinkee, he reported he on tech, Apple. Yeah. He's an Apple expert. Like, yeah, I don't own a smartwatch. I don't really aspire to own a smartwatch. I'm the kind of guy who, if I could get away from the phone more, I would even, to be honest.
Okay.
I'm an analog guy, not a digital guy, you know?
Right. One watch that we should all check out.
Ooh, interesting question.
Figure
off. Yeah, but that's like, you'll check that out anyway. Like, what's something you might not check out that is super interesting? Two brands, one vintage, one modern.
Okay.
Vintage, I would check out Cami, C-A-M-Y. Very interesting.
C-A-M-Y, okay.
The story is fascinating. It was developed in Switzerland for the Asian markets during those Asian markets were blowing up. And eventually it turned into Raymond Weil later on, many years later. But at the time they were making incredible tool watches that were like hanging with like Doxa, some of the Omegas. They were making sweet tool watches. Look at the Cami 7Cs, the Cami Rally King. So that's a cool vintage brand to check out. I think modern, where should people be looking? I'm a huge proponent of Zadeutsche watches like Sinn and Müller Glashütte. I think Müller Glashütte and Sinn are putting out awesome watches that people don't pay attention to German watchmaking enough. So I would check out some of their stuff. Yeah. The Sinn U50 is a good example. Yeah.
One book that you would recommend that blow your socks off.
Not book, watch related, I'm assuming.
Yeah.
Is it watch related or no?
No, any book.
Oh, any book. Interesting. Anything. So Alex, I know you're a car guy, but Ken Purdy.
He's a book guy as well, by the way.
Yeah. All right. That's perfect.
Yeah. Quote guy. Give us a quote, Alex.
No, I'm going to give you a quote.
This guy, Ken Purdy, P-U-R-D-Y, Ken Purdy's Book of Automobiles. And it kind of chronicles the freewheeling, crazy race cars from the 40s, 50s, 60s, and kind of how life was back then. I think that's a great one. What else? What did I read recently that is good? Lindbergh's stuff, all of Charles Lindbergh's writing, I think is definitely worth checking out. But yeah, it depends. If is that going to knock your socks off? Sure, if you like planes and cars and watches. That kind of thing.
Yeah.
If you want a book that'll knock your socks off in general, I was going to make a good joke, but I won't make it. So anyway.
Okay. Tell us off air. Right. First place you'll go to when COVID is over.
Interesting. It depends on what's open at the time, but I would love to return to Thailand or just anywhere in Asia, to be honest. Like, kind of bored of America right now. You know?
Okay. Most difficult article you had to write?
That's an interesting question. I would say...
Yeah, these questions are better than the questions I set before.
So the cover story of volume 5 of the magazine, The Watch That Came In From the Cold, which is that also involves China and the guerrillas factions.
Is this a slow infiltration of the Chinese market by incorporating China into your article?
No.
Or to curry favor to your move into China? It sounds like it. Like, no, I know you don't do it for like a monetary benefit, but for political and for residence benefit, maybe you consider it.
Yeah, maybe.
We should sign you on part-time as well to work with us.
There you go. Get that visa. That story was about a CIA contractor who was flying a secret mission in China that got shot down. And then the American government had to work with the Chinese government to get his remains. Among his remains was a Rolex.
Oh.
It's a great story. Not because I wrote it, it's just the story itself is awesome. That took a ton of research, fact-checking. It took a long, long time going over like case reports from the CIA.
Wow.
And yeah, it was a wild story. So that's called The Watch That Came In From the Cold.
Like Cole's saying it, but I watched that YouTube video and you two maybe should find some time to watch it. The amount of research Cole does is very admirable that he saved us time that we don't have to do it. Like when he quotes the sources he used and the documents he produced, where in the whole document you just see one line and he's siphoned through how many documents just for that one line, that name, you really appreciate what is good journalism. Like if I was gonna pay, yeah, I'll pay for that. I'm definitely all paying
right
for that shit.
Well, hey, I'll give you my Venmo right now.
Did you work with FOIA for that as well? Did you work with the government?
Yeah, he mentions FOIA.
So like, FOIA. He mentions it as well. Right.
He mentions numerous. This is like, so watch it. He mentions numerous sources that he uses that he hopes other people can use.
Yeah, okay, like Fold 3 is good. There's a bunch of databases you can come through. Yeah.
You can see that I watched it to the end.
You did. You're...
Or you skipped to the end and missed the middle bits.
So yeah, you're a good journalist because you prepared for the interview, you know?
Right. Person you get on the best with at Hodinkee?
I would say Jack is a bit of a mentor. His writing style, his demeanor, everything, I vibe with Jack for sure. So I get along with him and I see him as a mentor. James, I'm good boys with. We hang out. Honestly, everyone, to be honest. Like Danny Milton, I had a beer with him the other day. We all get along great, I got to say. But
okay, great. So last question. Are you subscribed to the Waiting List podcast?
No.
Yeah, you better sort that one out.
I'll definitely do it.
Here's a cheeky way to just get one more follower.
Look, we need an extra follower so Daniel can pay for his kids' education.
I think, are you on it? So my podcast, the only one, I'm not even subscribed to Hodinkee Radio. I'm only subscribed to 99% Invisible. That's my favorite podcast of all time. So when I listen to podcasts, it's more like if someone links to it or whatever, you know? So
yeah.
I'll follow you guys wherever for sure.
Yeah, I was going to say, shut the crap, just follow it. Right, now that really does end this episode. I think quite a good one, actually. Like, very geeky, really very bit nerdy, bit geeky. But for all you guys complaining that we don't do enough watches, I think, yeah, listen to this one then. Yeah, and then come back to me. And we'll see you guys on the next one. See you later, guys. Thanks a lot, Cole.
No, thank you. Thanks for your time, Cole. It was really good. Pleasure's mine. Thank you.
Shay.
Pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you for tuning in to the Waiting List podcast. Hit the subscribe button and the next episode will come straight to your phone as soon as it's ready. Whilst I'm here, please remember to leave a nice review and follow us on Instagram @thewaitinglistpodcast.